Chapter 6. Once the invincible reason had translated fully into the warp, protected from the maelstrom of energy by its Gellerfield, the Dark Angels took the offensive. As had been proposed by Lady Fiana, the Nephila were much weakened, unable to draw on the power of their realm, making them vulnerable to the weapons of the Dark Angels. With the newly restored librarians and the lion leading the purge, every part of the battle barge was scoured, the remnants of the attackers driven out of hiding to be gunned down. For 2 days, the scourging continued. Passageways and gun decks, engine rooms and mess halls, dormitories and drill ranges resounding to the roar of bolters and the vengeful battle cries of the First Legion. Nearly 300 Dark Angels had fallen during the fighting, many of them within the first hours of the assault. More than twice that number of Legion serfs and crew had also been slain. The Apothecarium was filled with those legionaries who had survived, some of them with hideous, grotesque wounds that festered with unnatural decay, or continued to blister and bleed despite the best efforts of the apothecaries. Amongst those being treated was Fiana, who had survived the backlash of her third eye, but only barely. She looked to be a wizened, aged crone as she lay in her bunk, her body otherwise undamaged, but her mind, dislocated by the psychic assault, suffered at the whim of the Nephila. Despite this, she and her fellow navigators did all they could to assist the legionaries. Cut off from the warp by the Gellerfield, the Nephila's presence was easily discernible by their other sight, and they guided the Dark Angels' kill squads unerringly to their targets, no matter how dark and isolated their hiding places. On top of this, the navigators had to guide the invincible reason to Perditus, pressed to find the utmost speed by the urging of the Dark Angels' Primarch. It was 8 more days of travel before the navigators announced that they were in the vicinity of Perditus. Lady Fiana had recovered a little more from her ordeal and was able to take her place in the rotor of navigators steering the ship. On reaching their destination, she requested an audience with the lion before she would allow the invincible reason to translate back to real space. As before, the lion met with her in his throne chamber, attended by Stenius and Corswain. Fiana had noticed the Seneschal check on her condition several times when she'd been in the Apothecarium, but she had not had the opportunity to discuss what they'd encountered. Now was not the time. The lion was clearly impatient with the delay in translation.
"There is something amiss, Lorded Primarch,"
Fiana explained when the Primarch demanded to know the cause of her hesitation. She was forced to lean heavily on a cane that one of the Tech Marines had constructed for her from a length of ribbed piping, its finial fashioned from a piece of jet-black stone, the ferrule made from a carefully cut section of the material used in the joints of power armour. Her voice had become a wheezing whisper, her words punctuated by heavy gasps.
"By all calculation and observation, we have reached Perditus. Yet for the last 3 hours, we have been unable to sight any warp beacon to confirm this categorically."
"The storms," suggested Corswain.
"On the contrary, the warp is incredibly placid in this locale, disturbingly so. There is almost no movement whatsoever, as if the currents have been flattened, stretched into non-existence. It is this dampening effect that I believe obstructs the beacon signals."
"It is no mystery," said the lion, his expression easing into a less agitated state. "We observed the same when we first came here. This pooling phenomenon is, I was led to believe by the Mechanicum, a side effect of the work they're performing at Perditus. It confirms that we have arrived. Make arrangements for translation as soon as possible, Captain Stenius."
"There is something in the warp causing this oddity, Lorded Primarch,"
insisted Fiana, taking a laboured step towards the Primarch.
"I and the others feel its presence, sense the pressure it is placing on the warp. The stability here is hiding a far more turbulent undercurrent."
"Your observations have been noted, Lady Fiana," said the Primarch. He stood up, ending the conversation. "Please continue to make your reports on the matter to Captain Stenius." Fiana railed against this casual dismissal, unable to shake the disquiet she had felt at this sinister discovery, but knew better than to debate the matter with a Primarch. He was already turning his attention to Corswain. She dipped her head in acquiescence, understanding that the mystery would have to be solved another day. Several Dark Angels ships had already made transition to the Perdita system when the Invincible Reason broke through into real space and established contact, though nearly a dozen vessels were still in transit in the warp. Fleet movements had never been easy through the warp, and the storms had exacerbated the problem considerably. It was one of the main reasons the Dark Angels had been unable to force a decisive encounter with the Night Lords in Thramas. By the time sufficient vessels arrived in a system to confront the enemy, the elusive Night Lords had time to escape direct conflict. The Lion weighed up his options: to wait for more of his flotilla to arrive, or to press onwards towards the Mechanicum station on Perdita's Ultima. Surmising that the Iron Hands and the Death Guard would both be aware of their arrival, the Primarch saw no cause for delay and directed the five ships present in his fleet to advance in system at full speed. Passing the uninhabitable gas giants at the edge of the system, the Dark Angels picked up sensor readings of two fleets engaged in a protracted maneuver for position around Perdita's Ultima, the closest planet to the star, on the very edge of the habitable zone. Ident codes and intrafleet signals marked out the vessels as Iron Hands and Death Guard ships, each flotilla numbering no more than half a dozen ships. Even combined, they would be no match for the might of the Dark Angels that would be arriving. Despite hails, communications could not be established with either fleet or the ground station on Ultima. Crossing the orbit of Perdita Secundus, just 5 days from their destination, the warriors of the First Legion were in range to detect forces deployed onto the surface of Perdita's Ultima. Comm intercepts indicated that a stalemate persisted there as well as in space. The ships of both the Iron Hands and Death Guard were conducting an extra-orbital ballet, each trying to gain position over the world to support their troops on an offensive action. But neither was able to gain the upper hand without risking a decisive and potentially devastating spaceborne engagement. Thus, the two sides were locked together at arm's length, neither prepared to wage a possible defeat against a push for victory. Summoning a council of his captains, the Lion determined a course of action for the Dark Angels. "We will position our fleet directly between the Iron Hands and Death Guard, and announce that all hostilities are to cease," he told the assembly of officers gathered in his throne room aboard the Invincible Reason. "If neither side is willing to risk an engagement with each other, for certain they will not be keen to take on a fresh foe." "A risky proposition, my liege," said Captain Massabail, commanding the frigate intervention. "What is to be gained by placing ourselves in harm's way? Our arrival and numbers will be known to both sides already. There is no reason to expose ourselves to the danger of direct attack." "Purpose and threat," replied the Lion, smiling coldly. "We are to make our intent and determination crystal clear from the outset, lest our adversaries think we issue idle demands. Perdita's is under the aegis of the Dark Angels, and the sooner we establish the fact, the swifter we will conclude our business here and return to the battle with the Night Lords." "What of the Death Guard, my liege?" asked Corswain. "Should we not simply attack with the aid of the Iron Hands? They are known to have declared with Horus from the earliest days of the rebellion."
"Until we can establish the loyalty of both factions here, and that of the Mechanicum as well, we should not suppose any aid from either side. The Iron Hands have been leaderless since Manus was slain at Istvan. Who can say what their current agenda is or where their true loyalties lie? Similarly, it has been reported that those legions that sided with Horus did not do so wholly. Whole companies and fleets have been spread far across the galaxy, and with the warp storms isolating many sectors, we must not hastily prejudge any situation, little brother. It may be the case that in Perdita's it is the Death Guard who are loyal, and the Iron Hands who have turned from the Emperor's cause."
Corswain absorbed his Primarch's wisdom with a nod, while Captain Stenius took up the conversation.
"Is it your intent that we shall also gain position to place troops on Perdita's Ultima, my liege?" said Stenius. "Are we to break through the Iron Hands and Death Guard cordons for low orbit?"
"That is exactly my intent, Captain Stenius," replied the Lion.
"The Invincible Reason will spearhead the thrust to Perdita's Ultima, passing between the lead elements of the two enemy fleets. We shall broadcast warnings that any hostile action will be met immediately and decisively with overwhelming force. I will issue fleet instructions when we have concluded here. Are there any more questions?"
The tone of the Lion indicated that he did not expect any further debate, and the assembled captains lowered to their knees to accept their Primarch's command. When the others were dismissed, Corswain loitered in the audience chamber, wishing to speak with his lord in private. The lion waved for him to speak his mind.
"It is possible that what you say is true, my liege, but the likelihood of the situation is that the Iron Hands are loyal to Terra and the Death Guard are sworn to Horus," said the seneschal. "We should arrange our advance to favour defence against attack from the Death Guard."
"As you say, little brother," said the lion. "Yet do not be so sure in the loyalties of the Iron Hands. We are living in complex times, Kor, and there is no easy division between those who fight on our side and those who fight against us. Antagonism towards Horus and his legions no longer guarantees fealty to the Emperor. There are other powers exercising their right to dominion."
"I don't understand, my liege," confessed Corswain. "Who else would one swear loyalty to other than Horus or the Emperor?"
"Whom do you serve?" the lion asked in reply to the question.
"Terror, my liege, and the cause of the Emperor," Corswain replied immediately, drawing himself up straight as if accused.
"What of your oaths to me, little brother?"
The lion's voice was quiet, contemplative.
"Are you not loyal to the Dark Angels?"
"Of course, my liege."
Corswain was taken aback by the suggestion that he might think otherwise.
"And so there are other forces whose foremost concern is their Primarch and Legion. And for some, perhaps, not even that," the lion explained. "If I told you we would abandon any pretense of defending Terra, what would you say?"
"Please, do not joke about such things," said Corswain, shaking his head. "We cannot allow Horus to prevail in this war."
"Who mentioned Horus?" said the Primarch.
He closed his eyes and rubbed his brow for a few moments, and then looked at Corswain, gauging his mettle.
"It is not for you to concern yourself, little brother. Prepare the task force for the attack, and let wider burdens sit upon my shoulders alone."
From his vantage point behind the armoured windows that pierced the central tower of Majelic Station, Captain Lasco Medoa had an uninterrupted view of the whole Mechanicum complex. His attention was directed to the south and east, towards outposts 7, 8 and 9, currently occupied by his Death Guard adversaries. Behind the low octagonal structures spread the mirrored screens that ran the circumference of the entire facility, creating a microclimate of thermal updrafts that assisted in keeping down the temperature at Majelic's, making it inhabitable, if not tolerable. Beyond were the upthrusts of Perdita's Ultima's mountains, their bases hidden behind a blanket of dense greenish fog 1,000 kilometres across, their summits many kilometres above the plain, glistening from golden refractive materials that coated the rock. The ever-present mist layer distorted the distances so that although the outer stretches of the facility were several kilometres away, their bulk was magnified to make them seem almost within bolter range. Heat shimmer from the mirror wall compounded the problem. It did not help the captain's sense of perspective to know that his foes were inside the stubby keeps, ready and able to launch an attack at any moment. With Medoa stood Captain Casilia Loramek, commander of the 98th Company. The two Iron Hands officers had their helms removed, making the most of the processed atmosphere inside Majelic's. For the bulk of the 38 days since they had arrived on Perdita's Ultima, they had been in full battle gear. The pair were almost identical, with close-cropped silvery hair, broad faces and leathery skin. Only two features separated them. Loramek had natural blue eyes, while Medoa had silver-lensed inserts. Medoa also had a tracheal respirator, replacing his lower jaw and throat, which hissed rhythmically with his breathing. When he spoke, his voice issued from a small speaker-comm unit set into the bone of his right cheek. The speech device transmitted Medoa's words in a sing-song cadence that was quite at odds with his mechanical appearance.
"And you are sure that they are heading directly for orbit?"
Medoa asked, responding to Loramek's report that the Dark Angels had continued towards Ultima at full speed.
"Yes, Iron Father,"
said Loramek, whose voice was deep and gravelly, each word uttered with gritted teeth and barely moving lips. Medoa was incapable of smiling at the use of the ancient honorific, but it was a source of pride that his fellow captains had chosen to raise him up to command of this expedition.
"Course and speed are consistent with an orbital heading. They will be in high orbit in less than 3 hours."
"But they still have not breached the comm dampening shell."
"We have not yet been able to directly communicate with the Dark Angels."
"And what of them?"
said Medoa, pointing out through the window at the Death Guard positions.
"What are they doing?
The enemy seem intent on an intercept course, replied Loramek. With your permission, I will signal the fleet to countermaneuver. We will engage the Death Guard ships and provide a screen for the arriving Dark Angels. They have two battle barges amongst their flotilla, which would be valuable orbital support.
You have my permission, said Medoa. We have an unforeseen and fortuitous opportunity, Casalier. Have all but one in 10 squads drawn down from their patrols and garrisons and mustered in the main vehicle pool. It is my intent to launch an attack.
It will be, as you say, Iron Father, said Loramek. With the aid of the Dark Angels, we will drive the Death Guard from Perdiccas and secure the Tichulka engine.
It took most of the next hour for Medoa to gather together the forces he required for the counteroffensive. Squads and companies were drawn in from their positions across Majelix and the surrounding rocky plateau, moving in secret along underground highways that had been dug beneath the surface of Perdiccas Ultima long before the Emperor's compliance fleet had arrived. The Iron Hands sallied forth from the main gateway of Tower 2, Predator battle tanks and Land Raider armoured carriers spearheading the thrust, while the forces' rhinos and the larger Mastodon transports followed behind the more heavily armed screen. Almost immediately, defensive fire from Tower 8 punched through the gloom of Perdiccas's atmosphere, stabs of laser and the flare of heavy cannon fire. The vanguard of the column spread out into covering positions, the tanks taking up stations behind enormous scattered boulders, jagged escarpments and the shallow ferrocrete blocks that housed the station's atmosphere filtration fans. Soon the return fire of the Iron Hands was lancing into the slab walls of the outer towers, ripping trails through ferrocrete and cracking massive glassite observation decks. Behind the storm of fire, the next wave charged onwards in their rhinos, hatches and doors battened down as the transports roared across the undulating rocky ground at full speed. Medoa was in the lead vehicle, keen to set an example for his warriors to follow. The slower, bulkier mastodons, each quadruple tracked and towering above the Land Raiders, powered through the dust and fog as quickly as they could, their heavy tracks carving fresh ruts in the baked surface of Perdiccas Ultima. Before they reached Tower 8, the Iron Hands came into range of the guns at Tower 9. Medoa had known this, and speed was the best defence against the strengthening crossfire. There were 300 metres of ground to cover where both towers could fire at full intensity before the bulk of Tower 8 obscured the arcs of fire of its neighbours. Being first across the killing zone had its advantages. The gunners were unable to adjust their aim quickly enough to target Medoa's rhino, but 10 metres behind him, Sergeant Haltiz's transport was struck full on by a las cannon beam. Engine boiling smoke, the breached rhino skidded to a halt, the black and silver armoured warriors within spilling out onto the dusty rock while more transports poured past them. Medoa's orders had been simple. Stop for nothing. The Iron Hands in the other transports barreled past their stranded brethren, knowing that the surest way to protect their fellow legionaries was to mount an assault on the gun positions manned by the Death Guard. The 15 seconds it took to dash through the blazing kill zone was the longest 15 seconds Medoa had felt in his life. He was crouched in the rear compartment with his command squad, all of them tensed and ready to extract if a hit forced them to bail from their transport, even while it was moving. Over the comm, Medoa learned of a second rhino being hit, and then a third. But by the time the lead transports were within 100 metres of Tower 8's secondary gate, seven of the rhinos and three Land Raiders had pierced the cordon of fire. A further 8 mastodons followed behind, each carrying 40 Iron Hands warriors, their power field soaking up autocannon shells and las cannon blasts with actinic flashes of energy. As the rhinos slew to a halt beneath the guns of Tower 8, Captain Tadurig and his squad disembarked swiftly, approaching the wall of the tower ahead. With them, they had brought a phase field generator, a device Medoa had overseen the creation of since arriving with the aid of his Mechanicum allies. It took only a few seconds for the Iron Hands legionaries to assemble the four-legged platform and install the phase field generator, the bulk of the machine taken up with an energy distillation dish at the centre of which were thousands of wire coils to transmit the phase field into place. Joining his warriors, Medoa made a last few adjustments to the machine which he had painstakingly assembled and rigged from old tunnel delvers and other pieces of warp tech machinery left over by Perdiccas's previous inhabitants. They had used the channeled power of the warp as freely as the Imperium employed plasma and electricity, much to the amazement of Medoa. With a thrum of magnetic actuators sliding into position, Medoa pulled the activation lever and stepped back. He had not yet had time to test the device. He had been planning on using it during a subterranean assault on Tower 9 in a few days' time, but he knew that in theory it would work. Muttering an old Medusan proverb, he waited for the power capacitors to reach full potential and then switched on the conductor coils. The phase field sprang into life, looking like a cone of pearlescent energy. Everything within the field disappeared, including a circle of the Tower 8 wall some 3 meters in diameter. After a few seconds, Medoa signaled for the machine to be shut down and, with his squad on his heels, stepped through the newly made gap. Inside, the phase field had displaced a swathe of the room within the tower, along with another interior wall and the ceiling 20 meters further on, exposing the floor above and a basement level below. Neatly severed cables sparked while sliced atmosphere recycling pipes dribbled contaminant-laden steam into the air. Their suit lamps piercing the darkness inside the tower, the iron hands pushed on, with weapons ready.
"What do you mean, Tower 8 has been breached?" Kalos Typhon, first captain of the Death Guard Legion, commander of the Grave Wardens, was in a foul mood already, and the news of the Iron Hand's success did not improve his humour.
"A phase field generator, Commander," replied his second, Captain Vios, who was forced to take a step back as his senior turned. Typhon and his subordinates' massive suits of Terminator armour almost filled the command blister on the top of Tower 7.
Vios's voice was a low, slurred hiss, his speech impaired by an ugly, suppurating wound in the right side of his jaw.
"Saren has too much focus on the gateways, and the breach through the wall has him outflanked."
"Why now?" demanded Typhon, his top knot of dark hair flicking like a horse's tail as he twitched his head in annoyance. "Have they received some signal from the Dark Angels?"
"Impossible, Commander," said Vios. "The Terminus S dearth field is still functioning. No communication is able to pass from surface to outer orbit."
"And the Dark Angels continue on their course directly towards Perdita's Ultima?"
Vios nodded, his sallow face deeply creased by a scowl.
"They will have orbit in less than 2 hours, Commander."
"Then we have less than 2 hours to punish our idiot foe for his foolhardiness. He should have waited until orbital supremacy was guaranteed. Signal the fleet and tell them to stave off engagement as long as possible. That should afford us an extra hour at least while the Dark Angels are forced to consider their options."
"You plan to bring forward the next attack, Commander?"
"Yes, right now, may the devil take your eyes!"
Typhon crashed his fist into Vios's shoulder, sending him reeling into the wall of the glassite-domed cupola. Motes of rust drifted in the air from the impact, shed from the corroded edges of Vios's armour.
"We must flee to Shulkar while we have the chance. A lot depends on our success here. Tell Grusel to assault from Tower 9. We will trap our enemy between us and drive onwards to the central facility."
"For the Father," said Vios, bowing his head. "The Grave Wardens will not fail."
The subterranean passageway was 5 meters high and twice as broad, lit by thin, dust-covered yellow strips in the floor and ceiling. The rails of an ancient locomotive system rusted at the center of the tunnel, and raised platforms ran along the walls to either side. Normally it was a gloomy place, but the arrival of the Iron Hands and Death Guard had turned it into a place of pyrotechnic brilliance. Bolt of fire echoed along the 500-meter length of the interchange, the shells expelled by the exchange hurtling in both directions in a criss-cross of bright flares. Now and then, the miniature blue star of a plasma shot shrieked across the gap, or the red flare of a missile trail illuminated the murkiness. Blossoms of frag missile detonations appeared amongst the line of 20 Death Guard Terminators advancing on Tower 8. At their head, Commander Typhon roared his men onwards. Like his warriors, he was protected by the massive bulk of his modified cataphractii armour, painted white in the colours of the Death Guard. Rounded plates that heaped up higher than the top of his knightly helm protected his shoulders. His chest and gut encased in segmented slabs of ceramite, arms and legs sheathed in thick greaves and vam braces. Adamantium mail hung in sheets across the joints of his armour, The left arm of his suit was incorporated into the bulk of a Reaper autocannon, its twin barrels spitting a rapid-fire hail of shells towards the Iron Hands, chewing through the ammunition belt like a starving dog devouring a strip of sinew. In his right, Typhon held a Man-Reaper, a wickedly bladed power scythe, symbol of his rank, and a smaller copy of the weapon wielded by his Primarch, Mortarion. The glow of its power field shone, a sickly yellow light, on the white Terminators around him. Heavy support Terminators backed up the 20 warriors of the Spearhead, their cyclone launchers sending showers of missiles over the heads of their companions, detonations cracking the plastite sheathing of the tunnel walls and tossing silver and black armored legionaries into the air. Combi bolters spat rapid-fire rounds as the Grave Wardens continued to close, marching unharmed into the teeth of the enemy's fire. The Iron Hands fell back, unable to match the Grave Wardens with their heavier armor and weaponry, but progress was slow. Grusel had reported entering Tower 8 20 minutes earlier, yet Typhon was still 2 interchanges from breaching the tower from below. He was expecting word from Vios at any moment, telling him that the Dark Angels were in orbit, but until then, he was determined to press on with the attack. The leading squads of the Grave Wardens were within 50 meters of the end of the interchange held by the Iron Hands when Typhon's helm crackled with a signal of an incoming comlink. Rather than the sibilant whisper of Vios, he heard a deep voice filled with authority that caused him to involuntarily stop in his tracks. Around him, the rest of the Death Guard were similarly immobilized, and the fire from the Iron Hands died away within seconds.
"The world of Perdita's Ultima is under the control of Lion L. Johnson of the First Legion," boomed the message. "You are to immediately cease all warring and quit this planet. Any resistance will be met with ultimate force, and there will be no prisoners taken. Failure to comply with my demands will result in your immediate destruction."
As if breaking from a trance, Typhon staggered forwards a step, almost losing his footing. Only in the presence of Mortarion had he ever experienced anything like the reaction he had just felt, and he quickly realized that it was not just the Dark Angels that had arrived. Their Primarch was with them. He could sense the unease of his warriors as they came to the same conclusion, and the advance that had shuffled to a halt was slowly turning into a withdrawal. Ahead, the Iron Hands were backing away from their positions too, cowed by the same tone of authority that had pierced the minds of the Death Guard. Typhon gritted his teeth and shook his head to rid himself of the fugue that had descended on him following the Lion's proclamation. He knew that there was something else at work here, not just the innate command of a Primarch. Typhon opened up his mind to the warp, sensing the waves of energy that were part of, yet separated from, everything in the material universe. When he had been a member of the Librarius, his powers had been considerable. Mortarion's hatred of warpcraft had finished Typhon's exploration of his other nature when the Dusk Raiders became Death Guard, and so he had committed himself to becoming First Captain. Now, with the encouragement of darker sponsors, Typhon had once again embraced the warp-born side of his powers, learning far more about the universe and its mysterious ways than he had ever thought possible. It was this that had first brought him in contact with the Father, and it was his warp self that now detected the gentle interplay of energies being directed at the surface of Perdita's Ultima. It seemed the Lion was no longer impressed by the Council of Nikea's decision either, and had allowed his librarians to reclaim their birthright. With this knowledge, Typhon was able to extend a little of his will, seeking a means to block the resolve weakening presence of the Dark Angel's librarians. Despite his personal prowess, he was up against several trained minds, and so he turned to that shadowy force that had accompanied him these past years. He asked the Father for help, and help was granted. With a surge of psychic energy buzzing through him, its touch like the tread of 1,000 tiny insects in his mind, Typhon cast a pall of shadow over his Grave Wardens, shielding them from the assault of the Dark Angel's psychers. Almost immediately, they ceased their withdrawal and turned to him, expecting orders.
"Fools!" he rasped, pointing his Man-Reaper at the retreating Iron Hands. "Now is not the time to step back. Now is the time to attack. Slay them all!"
In a darkened chamber in the bowels of the Invincible Reason, the Lion stood between 4 of his librarians, listening to their murmuring voices.
All of the Psykers had donned their old ceremonial robes of blue, their faces hidden by the shadows of the cowls pulled over their heads. It was better that this was kept from the sight of the ordinary battle brethren. Confusion and hearsay could breed superstition faster than any explanation could thwart it. Corswain stood to one side, his agitation audible as he shifted his weight from one foot to the other and back again, his armour creaking with each movement. The lion ignored his seneschal's discomfort. This way was better, cleaner. If the Death Guard and Iron Hands could be forced to parley without fighting, it would be in the best interests of the Dark Angels. The lion sensed Corswain straighten, and he turned his gaze upon the seneschal. "It's not working, my liege," said Corswain, sounding relieved by the fact. "Sensors show that the Iron Hands are retreating from a renewed Death Guard assault. They're being pushed back into the main facility."
"I warned them," snarled the lion. "None will doubt my authority."
"Shall I signal Captain Steenius, my liege?"
"Yes. If the Death Guard do not comply with my wishes, Majelic Station will be obliterated. Tell Steenius to launch the torpedo."